Welcome to episode 28 for the 10th of April, 2007. It's about 5 in the morning here, and we're going to kick things off with Dirty Harry, talking about the guy with the biggest handgun in the world. And gosh, you don't want to cross Dirty Harry, and find out why in a few minutes. Then we'll have a trivia question, as always. Next, the Film Buffs Dictionary. We're going to talk about cinematography. This time, Steven's going to break down aspect ratios and anamorphic widescreen and open mats and all those sorts of terms for us. Our top six list is the top six movie dates. People go out on a date in a movie. Well, if that's a memorable scene, we want to talk about it. And wrapping things up, we'll conclude our series on animation with talking about computer 3D animated films. I'm Sam Stoddard.
And they call me Dirty Steven. I know what you're thinking right now. You're thinking, did he put five films on his list or all six? Well, I guess you've got to ask yourself one question, Sam. Do you feel lucky? Well, do ya?
I know what you're thinking. Did he fire six shots or only five? Well, to tell you the truth, in all this excitement, I kind of lost track myself. But being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do ya, Steven?
Well, wait. Hey, Clint, how you doing? Where's Sam at?
Oh, well, careful observers will note that not only wasn't that Clint, but I actually substituted the word punk for a word of my own. I'll leave it as an exercise for the listener to guess which one that was. Anyway, of course I am quoting Harry Callahan, the hard-boiled renegade cop who gets things done his way or no way. The movie is Dirty Harry, made in 1971, and it was incredibly popular, eventually spawning four sequels made throughout the 70s and 80s. And part of its popularity is, if you think about it, it's sort of a precursor to the neo-noir genre, which we talked about recently. And in fact, Dirty Harry has some heritage in the crime and gangster flicks of the 30s that were precursors of film noir. So, you know, there's sort of a repeating cycle here. And as we're hitting the 70s, this is just going to be an incredibly popular type of genre with Chinatown and everything, and Dirty Harry is going to be a big part of sort of spawning this whole, fad. Anyway, each of the five movies had a different director, the fourth being directed by Eastwood himself, but they all handle this character consistently. Probably because, you know, the first movie does such a great job at fleshing out who this Harry Callahan guy is. And it's the character, probably more than the actual movie, that clicked with the public and that people remember today. There's something important to understand here. You know those renegade cop types? Pretty much every cop movie or TV show these days has a guy who just wants to catch the bad guys, and he's frustrated by the brass that keeps miring things down and procedures and protocols and red tape, and his bosses chew him out for his unorthodox methods, and he goes and gets the bad guys anyway. Well, anytime you see a character like this, it comes from Dirty Harry. That's how pervasive Dirty Harry's influence was. And of course, Dirty Harry had its own influences, but in any case, part of the rage is that 1971, we were really ready as a nation, I think, for a different kind of hero. You notice how throughout movie history, and really since, you know, the beginning of storytelling itself, we're looking for heroes. We want to see someone we respect and admire and can look up to fighting for what we want, whether it's the capture of murderers or terrorists or something less obvious, like rebelling against corrupt establishments. So as society evolves, we want our heroes doing different types of things, and it's whatever it is at the time that people are concerned with. And part of it is just a matter of taste, too. I mean, when James Bond came along, he was exciting because he wasn't quite like the heroes that had come before, and so it was new and exciting, and he was fantastical, ruthless and efficient, but a fantastical sort of character, and what he was doing was for fighting for freedom on a global scale. And World War II hadn't been settled for many years, and the books started coming out, and the Cold War was underway. So as a cultural mindset, kind of, as a national mindset, our minds were thinking pretty globally, so we wanted a global type of hero. But by 1971, the formula was wearing out a little bit, and that opened the door for something else to take its place. And on the global scale, the war on everybody's minds wasn't World War II, but Vietnam, which inspired a whole different set of reactions with the public. And so the patriotism thing wasn't cutting it for people anymore. And the other thing is urban crime was really on the rise at the time. And so this is kind of when cities became noticeably more dangerous places to live. And so what we were looking for was the lone renegade sort of character that always does the right thing, even if everybody on both sides is against him for doing it. And so that's Harry Callahan. And if you look at the early 70s, it's pretty obvious Dirty Harry was part of a bigger trend, because also in 1971, Shaft came out and The French Connection, and in 1974 there was Death Wish, probably inspired by Dirty Harry, but in any case, a number of movies with these gritty anti-heroes turning their attentions to inner-city crime. But none were so crisply defined as Harry Callahan, as portrayed by Clint Eastwood and directed in the first movie by Don Siegel, the great director of action and suspense. He'd worked with Eastwood before on the westerns Coogan's Bluff and Two Meals for Sister Sarah, and would do so again in Escape from Alcatraz. He's also known for directing the original version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Shootist in 1976, which was John Wayne's last movie. As for Eastwood, he was far from the first choice to play the role. The script was written with Frank Sinatra in mind, kind of a strange thing to contemplate, but Sinatra had broken his wrist years earlier and still had trouble with it, and he couldn't handle the .44 Magnum handgun all that well, so he turned the role down, and John Wayne turned it down, and Steve McQueen turned it down, and Paul Newman turned it down, and finally it got to Eastwood, who had made a name for himself in westerns by this time, and in things like The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, and but he was trying to do different things, and in fact, also in 1971, had made his directorial debut with the Hitchcockian thriller Play Misty for Me. Anyway, Harry Callahan became his signature role. It's just a fun character. There's a famous scene where he's eating a hot dog in a diner, and there's a robbery going on across the street, so he heads out to break it up, and he's still eating his hot dog as he's firing away at the bad guys. It's kind of an over-the-top thing when you think about it, but it looks cool, so, you know, and Eastwood's performance makes it absolutely convincing. The part of the villain in the first movie was to go to Audie Murphy, a real-life war hero of World War II, actually the most decorated U.S. combat soldier of World War II, and he went to Hollywood and became an actor when the war was over, but Murphy opted out of the role when he died in a plane crash. So, the villain Scorpio was ultimately played by Andy Robinson. Maybe not a name you know, but he certainly portrayed what I think is one of the creepiest villains ever. I mean, it's so creepy that I actually don't enjoy the first Dirty Harry movie so much, frankly. Despite, you know, that I recognize its achievement and its influence, but he was so effective in the role that he actually got a death threat over it and had to get an unlisted phone number. Which is weird because in real life, Robinson was this huge pacifist, and he hated guns so much he couldn't fire one without flinching, really dramatically even. And so Don Siegel had to shut down production to send him off on a training course to shoot a gun right. Now, the villain, as I say, is called Scorpio in the movie, and he seems to be based on the real-life Zodiac Killer, which was at loose in San Francisco at the time. And in the same year, 1971, another movie called The Zodiac Killer was released, which was, you know, more directly about the real-life case, and it's being remade this year by David Fincher as just Zodiac. But anyway, San Francisco is also where Dirty Harry is set, and this city becomes a key... you know, they say the setting is sometimes a character in movies, and San Francisco is certainly a character in the Dirty Harry movies. Four out of the five, anyway, are set there, and a lot of the famous landmarks of the city crop up throughout the series. It's one of those things that gives the Dirty Harry film such a distinctive look. Another trademark is Harry Callahan's handgun, a Smith & Wesson Model 27, which is a .44 Magnum, and has this great powerful sound to it. Sound editors must have loved working with that gun. And another trademark is how Harry's partners keep getting killed in the line of duty. And another trademark is how he's always clashing with his bosses in the police department. At this time in the country, we're pretty suspicious of establishments and organized governments and whatever. So the police department is always portrayed as being embroiled into politics and procedures and concern over the media image and everything. And Harry just wants to catch the bad guys and stop the killing. So he's always breaking rules. But it's by making new ones. Harry isn't just a loose cannon. He has his own code of ethics that he adheres to. And the second movie, Magnum Force, actually explores this in a really interesting way. Because it's about a gang of renegade cops who are also sick of the red tape and politics and gang up together and gun down bad guys illegally. It's a really fine line between that and what Harry himself does. But ultimately, Harry sides against these vigilantes, and that's the real strength of the first sequel, how it explores these critical differences in these seemingly similar codes of ethics.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I think so many of those trademarks of the series we now think of as total cliches in the cop movie genre, but really weren't at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, it had a huge amount of influence, and also, I think cliches become cliches because they work. It's on some level, and we see them as cliches and scoff at them when we see them reused in a story that they're not really built for, when they're used clumsily. But originally, these things became cliches because they made sense in a story and made a good story. So yeah, you see it work in one place, you want to copy it. All five movies are good, by the way. The fifth one is borderline good, and the other four are quite good. The first movie, I should warn you, as I say, is quite disturbing and violent, even by today's standards. There's a scene where Scorpio pays a guy to rough him up, and I won't say why, but he beats the tar out of the guy, and it's quite uncomfortable to watch. And if this is your reaction as well, just note that the sequels are quite a bit less violent than this, less creepy and disturbing. They still pack a punch. You know, they're rated R for a reason, but they're much more palatable. So if you want to skip the first one, that's okay. And if you can take this stuff, and, you know, certainly there's a lot of stuff even on TV today that is as violent, then definitely watch the first one as well. The series is not very interconnected, so you can watch these movies in any order without missing anything. So the third movie is called The Enforcer from 1976, about some former Vietnam veterans that blackmail the city, and the climax takes place on Alcatraz Island, because of course we got to get these San Francisco landmarks in there. And that was originally supposed to end the series, but 7 years later, this character is still incredibly popular. And there's when Sean Connery was making Never Say Never Again in 1983, that was eventually released, the marketing department of that film did this survey, and they asked people, well, name an actor and a role he plays, or just any. And a shocking number of people came back and said Clint Eastwood is Dirty Harry. And so they said, well, maybe we should do another Dirty Harry movie. So they made Sudden Impact. And this is the movie, not the first one, that introduces the line, go ahead, make my day. Now, I didn't see these movies till I was an adult, which is probably a good thing, but I remember at the time, in the early 80s, when I was 10 or 11 or so, everybody was quoting this line. Little kids in the playground, go ahead, make my day. Boys getting in a tussle or something, go ahead, make my day. No, you go ahead, you make my day. For all I know, a lot of them hadn't seen the movie either. You didn't have to have seen it. It was just one of those lines that caught on everywhere, like wildfire, and permeated pop culture, to the point where the president, President Reagan, was quoting it. He famously said, make my day, to drive home his threat to veto any legislation that would raise taxes. That was one of the things that made Reagan such a hugely popular president. But in any case, when you get presidents quoting movies, you know that something has really caught on. And yet, when you go back and watch Sudden Impact today, the original delivery of the line still works. Sometimes these things just become too familiar so that when we hear them in their original context, you know, it feels like a cliche, and even if you know it, this was the first time, it doesn't really work. But Eastwood says it with such conviction, I mean, you just want to cheer, it works so well. But you know what? Actually, the line didn't originate in Dirty Harry at all. It appeared in a movie 1 year earlier called Vice Squad, in which Gary Swanson says, go ahead, scumbag, make my day. So it's not just the words that make things like this catch on. It's the movie and the character and the context. And the fifth movie, which wraps things up, called The Deadpool, was released in 1988, and it's quite a bit weaker than the other four movies, but still worth watching, especially for the great, very weird car chase scene, possibly a parody of the one in Bullet, the 1968 Steve McQueen film, but in any case, a parody of chase scenes in general, car chases in general, because Harry is speeding through the streets of San Francisco to outrun this tiny, cute little toy remote control car that has a bomb strapped to it. So if it catches up, the bad guys are going to detonate it, and that's it, you know, so he's got to outrun it. But you know how in car chases there's always this obligatory shot where you fly over some hill and you get the slow motion shot of catching some air over it? Well, they do this here, but with a toy car. It's just pretty hilarious, but weirdly, it works within the context of the movie, and it's funny without really undermining the thriller angle. And then the other noteworthy thing about the Deadpool is the brief appearance of Jim Carrey in one of his first film roles as a rock star. Not exactly a comic part, but he does get to use his trademark physical moves as he performs on stage.
Well, I'm wondering, Sam, how you think the films hold up. It's sort of often hard for movie series to go for several sequels. I mean, are the final movies worth watching? Is one of the things we only really want to watch the first one, or what?
I think they're worth watching, but I would not argue with somebody who saw the Deadpool and said, you know, that's not very good. But I think the first four, in any case, are pretty strong, even though I think even the first one today looks like something that you'd see, because as we've said, they get repeated so much and recycled, all the cliches, the character types and everything. All these cop shows use stuff from Dirty Harry, and the later movies sort of, you know, it feeds off itself too, because by the time of the later movies there had already been imitators. So when you look back at these, you might say, oh, well, it's a cop show, I don't know there's anything special, but it's a pretty good cop show. So if you're into the genre, then it's worth watching. And certainly it's interesting to see the history of this thing sort of starting all these cliches. I mean, started the whole genre, really. So that's where things stand. Five Dirty Harry movies, none of them bad. Eastwood decided after the Deadpool that he was getting too old to keep playing the character, so he quit, despite to this day getting requests to bring Harry Callahan back. I'm not exactly sure how that would work today. It's not even like bringing Rocky or Rambo back. It would be like bringing Rocky and Rambo back in the year 2022 to get Eastwood to play Dirty Harry today. It's time for another trivia question, and the trivia question for this week is about the movie that holds the record for the longest production schedule of a completed feature-length movie. And I'll go ahead and tell you what the length is. 28 years that it was in production. So, you know, green light and 28 years later, and a new generation of people working on the movie, I guess, you've got your movie. Anyway, think about what movie holds that record. If you can maybe come up with a guess of some kind, shot in the dark, we'll get back to you later in the episode to see if you're right.
We're moving now with our Film Buffs Dictionary to look at some more cinematographic... Wow, I didn't come close to pronouncing that word correctly. But you know what I mean.
It's a tough one.
To talk about...
Cinematographic.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some cinematographic techniques here. Mainly talking... We've talked sort of about camera movements and stuff, which kind of fall into it. But we're going to talk more specifically about the composition of shots and the terms involved in actually filming scenes, that kind of thing. And so we're going to get started with a talk about aspect ratio, something that probably people are a lot more familiar with today than they were even 10 or 15 years ago because of widescreen TVs and DVDs presenting us with a lot more options. So it's something you've probably heard of. But just to be clear, the aspect ratio is the ratio of the generally the width to height. So you think of a film as being a rectangle, and it's longer than it is tall, and we take the long number, and we put it with a ratio to its height. So sort of standard television, your television, if it's not a widescreen TV, it is, we call it 1.33, or 1 1/3 to 1. So it's 1 1/3 times as long as it is tall. You also sometimes see this expressed as 4 to 3, because it's the same thing. For every 4 inches wide that it is, it's 3 inches tall. For every inch tall that it is, it's 1 1/3 inches wide. And it's important because this really determines how you film a scene. What aspect ratio you're using is going to determine how wide your shot is. Now, one of the reasons this is so interesting is because the human eye sees things wider than we do tall. Our peripheral vision extends sort of greater than our vision up and down. You know, just try moving your hand around your head. You know, you can see more things to the side than you can see up and down, just because that's the way it works. So with square pictures, we kind of perceive them almost as inherently less interesting and less realistic almost. That's, I think, why people love to see panorama images, that kind of thing. There's almost just something dynamic about rectangular images. If you ever do any sort of graphic design work, you know, one of the things people always stress is stay away from using a lot of square images. People just naturally like rectangles, whether they're vertical or horizontal. And in film, they're always going to be horizontally. We're not going to project things vertically because that's just going to look really screwy, because that goes completely against what we want. So we want film to kind of replicate the way human vision works. And so this causes some contention throughout film history. Now, silent films all basically use the entire available area on 35mm film. And that's a rectangle that is about, again, we're going to get the same number here, 1 and a third to 1, 1.33 to 1. That was the standard for silent films, really up until the late 20s when they switched over to sound film. And we've talked about this before when we talked about the history of sound, but eventually what they ended up doing was just putting the soundtrack on the film itself. And this caused problems because now you have less film area to use. And they didn't know quite what to do about it, but in America at least, and pretty much everyone else ended up doing the same thing, they standardized it by going ahead and simply using less of the film that was remaining so they could go back to the older 1.33 to 1. Actually, the so-called Academy format is actually 1.37 to 1, but it's close enough that it doesn't matter. And this is why television screens basically are the format that they are, 4 to 3 or 1 and a third to 1, because they were just emulating what film had at the time. Wanted to just go and use the same ratio, because that's what 35mm film is. Now, in the late 40s, early 50s, and throughout the 50s, Hollywood switched over to making things in widescreen, in part because they said, hey, we could do this, the technology exists, and TVs are square, let's make our movies more dynamic, let's make them more interesting, we can make them even wider. I mean, I think it's one of those things where you tend to think of televisions as being square. They're really not. They are rectangular. They're just not very rectangular. They're pretty square. 1 1/3 to 1 isn't that wide. So, you have a couple options. We're not going to switch away from 35mm film, which is inherently, you know, pretty squarish. So you could just go ahead and use less of the film. And this is a process what's called matting, where basically you just cover up part of the film and you just make it a rectangle. So you cover up, put black bars at the top and bottom of the film, either on the camera or in the projector when it's projected back in movie theaters, and then you can go ahead and have a more rectangular section to record your image on. The downside of that is you're not using as much of the film, you get less resolution, that kind of thing. So that's not the greatest thing in the world. So what they came up with was this concept of using the entire remaining bit of film, but squeezing the image using what's called an anamorphic lens. And if you've ever seen an anamorphic print, the images on it look really, really screwy. So they're going to use all of the remaining part of the 35mm film. You know, that part of it is going to be still used as a soundtrack, but the rest of it's going to have this image that's really squished together.
It's tall, skinny people.
Yeah, it's really screwed up.
That's my name for the format, is tall, skinny people format.
It requires a special lens called the anamorphic lens. Anamorphic is basically the process of distorting something like this along one axis. And then what they're going to do is have an anamorphic lens at the projector, which will project a wide image. So it looks square on film, but everything looks distorted. And then when you project it out, it looks wide and people look fine. And so then you get various different heights and resolutions. And so sort of the standard that they standardized on, which is called CinemaScope, was about 2.35 to 1. And since the 1970s, this has kind of changed around a bit to nowadays. Standard anamorphic is more around 2.4, but everyone still calls it 2.35 to 1. So that's pretty wide, you know, more than twice as wide as tall. That's really wide. But they just sort of changed around the way that film works a little bit, and to perforations on 35mm film and stuff, so that today most widescreen is not necessarily filmed using anamorphic lenses, and it's done at 1.85 to 1, so not quite that wide. And this is pretty close to what widescreen TVs are. Widescreen TVs are generally called 16 to 9, just because they go up to the nearest whole numbers, or if you write it down, that's 1.78 to 1, so a little less wide than standard widescreen. Most movies today, like I said, are 1.85 to 1. That's sort of the normal widescreen. And there are a bunch of other variants throughout history as well. Some really, really wide ones go up to like 2.7 to 1, 2.75, 2.8 to 1.
Ben-Hur was a really wide.
Yeah, that requires special different types of film, special cameras. Those kind of just phased out because it was just too expensive. The studios didn't want to spend the money. Obviously, if you go to 70 millimeter, you have some more options, and you take the soundtrack away and have digital sound, that kind of thing. But really, we're still pretty much sticking around at 1.85 to 1, or for anamorphic films, 2.35 to 1. Now, obviously, digital offers us a little bit more variety because you don't really have the same limitations. You have an actual sensor, though, that's going to be capturing at a specific width and height, but it's really easy to mat things, that kind of stuff. So maybe it's very possible that if we ever eventually move to completely digital filming and exhibition that we could see more variety. Now, one interesting thing is that some of the earlier widescreen movies played with different aspect ratios. Dr. Strangelove, very famously, some of the DVD copies of Strangelove are incorrect because Stanley Kubrick switched the aspect ratio for different scenes, which lends really different kind of looks to the movie. But by and large, this is going to go away. It's just kind of disconcerting to the audience, so most directors just go ahead and pick one. And again, like I said, 1.85 to 1 is going to be the norm.
And it's tricky, too, because there's a lot of artistic concerns about what aspect ratio you choose. You know, if you think about it, the really wide formats are great for scenery. You can see more of the horizon or everything. They're great for seeing multiple people in a frame because you have one person standing on one side and one on the other, and then they can be talking. But the Academy ratio, the 4:3, would be much better for close-ups, zooming up on somebody's face. That's the shape of their face. You don't have a super wide, short face.
Right. Faces are taller than they are long.
Yeah. But ideally in a movie, you'd want to have probably both of these types of shots, and so you have to choose an aspect ratio that and not only that, an editing style that accommodates both. So if you're widescreen, you probably have more often steady shots of two people in the frame at the same time and they're having a conversation. If you have an Academy ratio film, then you'd probably cut between people having a conversation, so you only see one at a time. Strange things happen as a result of your choice of ratio.
And there's one other thing worth talking about, which is something you'll hear mentioned before, which I mentioned matting as a possibility. If you're not going to use an anamorphic lens, you just mat, which is to cover up part of the film. One of the things that happened as movies became shown more and more on television and on video was this process called open matting, which I suspect will go away once we all have widescreen televisions. But a lot of directors who are shooting in the 1.85 to 1 aspect ratio will go ahead and film with television in mind, so they'll go ahead and frame their shots without matting the camera, so the camera captures to a full frame of 35mm, a very square 1.33 to 1 image, and then they'll just, for theatrical release, cover up the top and bottom. But they shot the movie so that you could remove those mats when it goes on a television. So actually, some movies, when they're shown on TV or put on video and they're not in widescreen, actually have more information. Now, we're obviously, you remember back to VHS days when people would rail against what was called pan and scan? This is the process of taking a widescreen movie and cutting off the sides to make it more square to fit on a TV, and then they would go ahead and actually just pan around. If, like, you know, if there's an important information on the right edge of the frame, they would sort of shift the point of view over there and then discard, like, the entire left half of the frame, which was really screwy. And if you watch some early movies that were put on video and some of those early pan and scans, they're really bad. You can really notice the camera, like, just shifting all around, scanning and panning.
And people talking to people off the edge of the screen, or their face isn't totally in view.
There are some really bad examples.
Yeah, it's terrible. Don't ever watch a movie in the wrong aspect ratio.
But open mat is interesting because it means that the full frame, or the non-letterbox version, actually contains more information. You don't lose any information on the sides. You gain information at the top and the bottom to complete the square. And so that's one thing you'll sometimes see. If you ever see a boom mic in a movie, especially in the movie theater, it's almost always because the projection is screwed up. In other words, that part was supposed to be matted out. So again, they didn't bother matting it when they filmed it, but the actual film is just, as the tops and bottoms, supposed to be covered up when it's projected, and the projectionist screwed up and didn't cover it. And so, of course, when they're filming the movie, they have this zone that they know that boom mics can be in on. They can be captured on film, but it's going to be covered up when it's shown, so it's not a problem. And so, obviously, in those cases, they're not filming it for open mat. But yeah, that is something that you have sometimes seen in the past. It's kind of interesting if you want more information to watch an open mat film. while there's a lot of romantic comedies and romances in movies, there are surprisingly few really memorable date scenes. You know, movie scenes where the characters go out on a date. We just don't get that often for whatever reason. So I thought that we would take a minute or 25 and in this week's top 6, talk about some of the all-time top 6 movie dates. So let's just get rolling here. I've got, for my number 6, a scene from a 1997 film called Gross Point Blank, directed by George Armitage and starring John Cusack as a hitman who goes to his 10th high school reunion with his old high school sweetheart, played by Minnie Driver. And it's particularly a great thing, and I'm talking here specifically about the reunion sequence itself, which I'm going to count as a date, because it sort of starts off all these jokes about Cusack being a hitman. People ask him, you know, where have you been for the last 10 years? What do you do? Oh, I'm a hitman. And they kind of laugh it off. Oh, okay, ha-ha, I think he's joking. And, you know, he's sort of muttering under his breath, boy, I really should have brought my gun. What was that? Oh, I said this should be fun. You know, it's kind of funny. And the entire sequence climaxes with a rival hitman trying to kill Cusack, and Cusack having to stab the other hitman through the neck with a pen. And it creates a little bit of, you know, that kind of romantic, light comedy stuff where Minnie Driver finds, you know, this dead guy covered in blood or whatever, and they got to roll him up in a carpet and throw him in an incinerator. Anyway, great date sequence.
I would expect nothing less from you, Stephen Keller, on a top 6 movie dates list. Actually, my number 6 is from a movie called Dead Again, so I guess I can't talk too much, but actually it's quite sweet, and it's a scene where the two main characters are, we've established what they're trying to do and the mystery they're trying to solve, and then there's this quiet moment toward the middle of the movie where they wind up at a little cafe or something. They're eating outside the cafe, and as it's closing or after closing, and have this just sweet conversation, I guess, and it's a good scene, but what really brings it alive is when you've seen the movie already and you're watching it a second time, because there's throughout the movie, but particularly the scene, a number of different cues and little things that you notice once you know the secret to the mysteries and everything. So it's actually quite an intriguing scene to watch on a second viewing.
That's interesting. I really like that movie, but I've only seen it the once. I don't remember that scene, so I'll definitely have to look for it when I see it again. Well, my number 5 is also not really a sweet scene at all. It's from Taxi Driver, the 1976 classic by Martin Scorsese. And it's a sequence where Robert De Niro plays the mentally unstable Travis Bickle, and he becomes obsessed with a woman played by Sybil Shepherd, and after some cajoling, he gets her to go to a date with him. And his location of choice is a porn movie at the seedy, rundown theater, which, of course, she sort of rejects him. But it sort of sets up the rest of the film, which has him going more and more unhinged because of this rejection. Really disturbing and creepy, but very memorable, and sets into motion the plot of a great film.
I would expect nothing less from you on a top 6 list of movie dates. All right, my number 5 is one that also made your list, I'm sure, so let's just talk about it when we get to it.
I hate when you do that, Sam. It just drives me crazy.
But it's just like you get mad. You're just like, oh, you took my number 1. So I don't want to deal with that.
All right, fine. Well, my number 4 is from a movie that I know you love, and it's 1927's Sunrise by F.W. Murnau. It's a silent expressionistic film, though there is some synchronized music and sound effects. There's no dialogue in it that's talky. But it's a wonderful movie about a man who's going to kill his wife because his mistress sort of convinces him to do that, and they're taking a boat out to the city ostensibly on a date, and he's going to drown her, and then has a change of heart. And they end up going out on this date on the town. And it's this wonderful, surreal sequence that's really kind of the highlight of this wonderful expressionistic movie, where the two of them just enjoy one of the most interesting and fun nights on the town ever in the movies. And it's really difficult to describe what makes it such an interesting sequence. I think, like a lot of great expressionist works, you really have to see it to understand. But if you have seen it, it's definitely memorable.
Yeah, wow, I wish I had thought of this. This would have made my list easy. Wonderful, wonderful scene. And it's the dominant image, I think, is the two of them walking through this expressionistic Night on the Town, and lots of people just crowded everywhere, having a good time, absolutely everywhere. It's just packed. And, you know, this kind of scene isn't that uncommon in the movies. We get a little montage of a couple doing various things and having a good time. That's pretty ordinary. But what's different about this one is just the sets, the lighting, how it's edited together, how this you see split-screen type of stuff where you see one image in one part of the screen and another image overlapping it in another part of the scene, and for whatever reason, it's just everything combines and becomes very evocative. And of course, story-wise, it's a pivotal moment in the story as well. So yeah, great choice there. My number four is a little less sensational. It's from Tom Jones, the Best Picture winner from 1963. Not a movie I actually like that much. I think it's pretty overrated. I do appreciate British comedy. This one just, I don't know, just gets it wrong or different from my taste or whatever. But there's a pretty memorable scene right in the middle where Tom Jones goes out with one of the many women that he meets through the course of the film, and for whatever reason, I don't really understand why it works. It's going to sound completely stupid as I describe it, but we see a series of intercut shots of them eating as they face each other, and as they face each other, they're really facing into the camera, so we see him facing into the camera, and then we cut to her facing directly into the camera, and they are the messiest, nastiest eaters you could ever imagine. Just all the sounds of chewing and slurping and everything is exaggerated, but their eyes are fixated on each other, and they're not really paying attention to what they're eating. They're just fascinated with each other, so there's a lot of body language and communication happening, although I'm not sure I know or care to know what they're saying.
Oh, okay, well, that's an interesting pick. My number three, if you weren't going to guess that I picked, I'm going to guess this is the one that you referenced earlier. Well, of course, I'm going to pick the date sequence from Pulp Fiction. This is a great moment between John Travolta and Uma Thurman. Travolta plays a guy who works for a mob boss, and he's supposed to take Uma Thurman out, and it's the mob boss's wife, so he's supposed to take her out for a date while the boss is out of town. And earlier in the movie, Travolta has learned that allegedly the boss, played by Ving Rhames, threw a man out of a several story high window because he gave his wife a foot massage. So here, Travolta has to take her out for a date and is kind of terrified of what might happen. And it's really great sequence where they go to a 50s diner and win a dance competition. And of course, it ends as so many of my picks end with a sort of tragedy where she mistakes his heroin for cocaine and overdoses, and you know they have to plunge a needle of adrenaline directly into her heart to get her to come back to life. But it's a great, interesting moment that's I really like the transition that starts with them just being really awkward around one another. Travolta doesn't want to be there at all and is terrified that if things go well, he could find himself being thrown off of a balcony or worse. And they develop an interesting chemistry and just a wonderful ending to the sequence where they finally have to revive Thurman is just great.
Yeah, it's a pretty flawlessly constructed scene. Two things I find remarkable about that. One, I love the dialogue in the beginning where Uma Thurman comes out with a video camera and is shooting John Travolta and asking him pop culture type questions. Very, very quintessential Tarantino-ian dialogue, you know, like you know, do you like the Beatles more or Elvis Presley?
Hey, Sam,
you know, maybe you like both.
You know, my favorite part about that is
what
is it that it's actually not in the movie?
It isn't.
No, it's a cut scene. But oh. It is a great moment.
I remember it as being in the movie. It's got to be in the movie.
Because they're later in the movie. She says, "Oh, hey, an Elvis man ought to love this." And she asked him that question, do you like Elvis or the Beatles more? But it doesn't make any sense in the theatrical cut of the film because she doesn't ever ask him that first question. And just later on, she says, an Elvis man ought to love this.
Oh, wow.
But it is on the DVD, and it is, you're right, that bit is great. Tarantino should have left it in.
That's the power of memory. Okay, well, anyway, and the other thing I like about it is the fact that when they get to where they're going and they end up dancing, it recalls Travolta's former stardom with Saturday Night Fever. A little different, but, you know, it recalls that. There's an overtone there. So he's playing with Travolta's image a little bit. It's kind of a neat thing. All right, well, my number three is a bunch of first dates. It's a collective first dates of Bill Murray and Andy McDowell in the movie Groundhog Day. And as you probably know, the idea of the movie is that Bill Murray is experiencing the same day, Groundhog Day, over and over again, and he's the only one that remembers that he's done all this before. And so, you know, he tries a number of different things, but there's this one particular subplot where he discovers that he, you know, actually likes Andy, the Andy McDowell McDowell character and wants to get to know her, and he's been a jerk to her in the past, so every day he's got to rebuild and fix that relationship. And so he goes out on a series of dates, and some of them go well, some don't, and he learns from his mistakes the next day and tries again, and it's a very sweet thing, but very good set of dates there.
Yeah, that is great, and I really do kind of love the way that, you know, Murray kind of starts off just trying to win her heart, just because it's something to do, because he's so bored for living the same day over and over, and it's kind of sweet the way that he actually grows to really care about her. Okay, well, my number two is a weird kind of date. Maybe it's cheating to pick it, I don't know, and it's the sequence from the movie Fargo from 1996 by the brothers Coen. It's one of the most memorable sequences in the movie. A lot of people absolutely hate this bit, in fact, but it's a bit toward the middle of the film where Frances McDormand, who is investigating this double murder, gets called up by someone she went to high school with, who asks her to go out to dinner with her, and she does, and she's happily married, and he, turns out, is not, and he thinks it's more of a date than she does, and she kind of keeps gently rebuffing his advances until finally he just breaks down and begins crying unexpectedly, and it's such a strange sequence, but I think really plays to the themes of the movie, talking about how people can become disconnected from other people and what the consequences of that are, and it's wonderfully contrasts this character who breaks down, wonderfully contrasts with McDormand's character, who is the only really balanced, adjusted person in the movie, and she's able to be that way because she has real connections to other people, unlike pretty much everyone else in the film who is just selfish and self-serving.
So let me tell a story for all the people who are interested in sort of the making of All Movie Talk and where it came from. I mean, Stephen had the idea about last summer, but years before that, 2 or 3 years or something, 4 years, we've of course both seen the movie High Fidelity, which is where this top six list idea came from, except it was top five in the movie, and sometimes we'd be in a chat room and just talking about movies, and what's your top five this, and what's your top five that. We'd trade top five challenges with each other, and so Stephen one day said, what's your top five movie dates, and that's where the idea for this segment came from, and I responded to him, and my number one choice was the scene from Fargo, and Stephen, you told me that that didn't count as a date.
I did?
And now you're using it.
I didn't
use it. Yes, you did. Yeah.
I don't remember that.
I'm not sure that really is a real date, you know. You like my other choices, but... so I didn't use it on this one.
Well, I remember doing that list, but I don't actually remember what we picked for it back in the day. I remember picking the Pulp Fiction sequence, but that's about it.
All right. Well, cheater. All right, moving on. My number two... It's a blind date in a movie called Play It Again, Sam by Woody Allen. And it's a Woody Allen play that he wrote, and it's a movie, you know, based on that play, and he stars in it. He did not direct it. It's one of the few he didn't direct, but it is very much a Woody Allen movie, and I think actually one that even if you don't like Woody Allen, you will like it. But it's about a guy who's really obsessed with movies, and in particular Casablanca, and he's always watching Casablanca, and he actually has the ghost of Humphrey Bogart offering him inspiration and how to get his own life together, and it's kind of funny how sometimes he uses plot points from Casablanca to sort out his own life and everything. But there's this great blind date in Play It Again, Sam, where he tries to act all cool, like his idol Humphrey Bogart and everything, but he's Woody Allen, so of course he ends up tripping over things and breaking things and knocking them over and making a complete mess of the thing, but it's hilarious because no matter what happens, even after everything is irrevocably lost, he always tries to salvage the situation by standing up quickly and acting all cool and smooth and everything. So it's an interesting movie, and Woody Allen's pretty good about writing about relationships, in particular the beginnings and ends of relationships, so that reality sort of grounds the humor in this.
Yeah, okay, well, my number one is a movie I think we've talked about a bit in the past because, you know, we're obsessed with Billy Wilder, but it's a sequence from Some Like It Hot from 1959 in which Tony Curtis is trying to seduce Marilyn Monroe, and to do this he goes about it in a very roundabout way because that's how people do things in screwball comedies. He pretends to be a rich millionaire and pretends to have this yacht, and he invites her out to it, and, you know, she accepts because, hey, there's a millionaire inviting her out. And then he pretends to be impotent, and, you know, which of course leads her to want to try to see if she can maybe cure his problem. And this is all compounded by the fact that the yacht is actually owned by this millionaire who is currently dating Jack Lemmon in drag, because the millionaire thinks that Jack Lemmon is a woman, and makes the bit even funnier. But yeah, the stuff between Curtis and Monroe on the yacht is just... absolutely hysterical and also really, really sexy at the same time. Just a great, great scene and a great movie. And my number one movie date.
Yeah, great pick. Well, my number one choice is from another Best Picture winner, and it would be Marty. Marty is this sort of plain-looking man in his mid-30s, and, you know, never found the right woman. His buddies are always trying to set him up and go on double dates and stuff. But he's pretty tired of that. He's been discouraged too many times, rejected too many times. Nothing seems to work out. Well, he winds up somehow at a party and on his own, and he kind of overhears and sees a situation happening where another man comes in with a woman, and I mean, they were blind dates, and this man doesn't like her, and so he winds up trying to ditch her, and he comes up to Marty and says, hey, you know, I got stuck with this dog for a blind date, and I need somebody to take her home. How about $5? And Marty says, well, look, you can't treat her that way. You can't do that. He's a, you know, a decent guy. And so this guy goes to find somebody else to do that, and as things work out, Marty goes over to this woman named Clara and talks to her, and there's this, you know, a tender moment, and she knows she's being dumped, and she ultimately rejects the replacement guy that her original date finds, but there's this tender moment between her and Marty where she cries on his shoulder, and then there's a dissolve, and suddenly they're dancing together and having a great time. It's beautifully done. I mean, we don't know all the details of what happens in the interim, but we know exactly what happened, really. And it's just beautiful. And it drives home an important point, I think, and that's that so often you don't meet the right person because you are out looking. Marty's this guy that's basically just given up on dating. And we get the idea that the story is about the same for Clara as well. And just by pure chance, these two people run into each other. Great movie, great moment, and very touching. So that's my number one pick.
Great. Well, let's go ahead and recap. My number six is a scene from Gross Point Blank from 1997 by George Armitage. Number five, Taxi Driver, Martin Scorsese's 1976 film. Number four, Sunrise by F.W. Murnau from 1927. Number three, The Great Diner Scene from Pulp Fiction by Quentin Tarantino from 1994. Number two, the scene that allegedly Sam inspired but I don't remember about from Fargo in 1996 by the Coen brothers. And my number one movie date, the scene from Some Like It Hot by Billy Wilder in 1959.
And my number six choice is the dinner after closing scene from Dead Again from 1991. Number five, John Travolta and Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction, Tarantino's 1994 film. Number four, Pig Out O'Rama from Tom Jones in 1963. Number three, The Collective First Dates of Bill Murray and Andy McDowell in Groundhog Day. Number two, The Blind Date, or one of them, in Play It Again, Sam, in 1972. And number one, The Date in Marty from 1955. Continuing our talk about animation, this is week number four, and this will wrap it up for the time being. And we'll talk about 3D animation, as we promised last week. You know, if Akira made a splash on the animation scene in the Western world, a Toy Story made a tidal wave. I remember seeing previews for Toy Story in 1995, and I was just amazed. I didn't know quite what I was looking at, even. The style of animation was so incredibly different from anything I'd ever seen. And I was actually pretty down on it at first. A movie about toys. I mean, it just sounded incredibly dumb. And as far story-wise, the trailer didn't really impress me, but... And of course, boy, was I wrong. I loved it and still do. But it's interesting to think back from now when 3D animation is absolutely everywhere to that first time I saw the Toy Story trailer in the theater, and I was just so bewildered by what this new look was. Do you remember that? Or were you born then?
Yeah, no. I think I'd actually seen some computer animation stuff before. Do you remember those Mind's Eye shorts that were around in the early 90s?
Oh, yeah. I had seen those.
It just that was my first introduction to computer animation, I think.
Yeah. I guess technically that was mine as well. It's just that, like, Toy Story...
But yeah, I saw Toy Story. I saw it in the theater and loved it. I was just blown away by how cool it looked.
Yeah. It's a neat time to think back on my impression when I saw that. I had seen the Mind's Eye things, but this was just, it seemed different. You know, the Mind's Eye seemed kind of geeky and not really something you could use for a movie with a story
right.
And characters and everything. And now suddenly, well, there it is. Kind of doubtful about how it worked, but it certainly worked wonderfully. Well, here's how 3D animation works. It's sort of like claymation that you do on a computer, much more like claymation than hand-drawn animation, because you start with models of all your characters and props and everything, and they're in the computer, but they're still models, they're digital models, and you drag and drop them around to build a scene, and you can control where the cameras are, the coordinates and angle of the cameras in this virtual space that you can work with, and even its focal length and all that of the, on the cameras. You can set up the position and color and sharpness of the lights to light your scene, and basically you set up the first frame of the scene you want to do. So far, it's pretty much like claymation, but in a computer. And then you jump around between keyframes, and this is where it's different from any other type of animation, where you do one frame and then make it all little changes for the next frame and take a picture of that and so on. With computer animation, you don't really work on a frame-by-frame basis for a whole movement. You start with, say, okay, I've got frame one, and there's a character sitting there or something. Now I want this character to have his eyes closed by the time we get to frame 11. And so I'll jump ahead to frame 11 and close his eyes. And the computer interpolates the rest for you. So when you play the thing, the computer will say, okay, I have to move his eyelids from here to here in 10 frames, and that tells me that his eyes should be 1/10 closed on frame 2 and 2/10 closed on frame 3 and so on. And the computer does that for you. You've got to set up the starting and end points of a movement. And so then you get a whole bunch of movements together, because probably what you want is not just a shot of somebody closing his eyes. You want to have some other movement taking place. So maybe the animator will jump into frame 5 and say, okay, starting from frame 5, I want you to move his head and start turning it to the left. And by the time we get to frame 15, his head is looking left, like this. So now when you render the scene, the character closes his eyes at first, and then right when they're half closed, it starts turning to the left, and by the time you get to 11, it's closed, and 15, his head is facing left. And so probably you do hundreds of these individual overlapping movements to get a final scene of animation done. Interestingly, everything ultimately boils down to numbers. You think of all these 3D graphic everything, but it's really a work in numbers, because what I've described, blinking the eyes and turning the head, these are two animation variables, or AVARs, I guess they call them, and these are parameters built into the digital models themselves that allow the animator to manipulate the model. So you got a model of a door, let's say, and probably only has one or two AVARs, one to determine how open the door should be, and maybe one to if you want to show the knob being turned back and forth. So that would be another one. And so if it's set to positive, I don't know, 5, then it's this open. If it's set to negative 5, it's open in the other direction. And if it's 0, it's closed. A character model might have hundreds or thousands of variables, especially in the face, where you need a lot of control over expressions. Maybe a dozen or so, say, just to control eyebrows. How high they are is one, how slanted is another, how curved is another. And, of course, you want to duplicate each set of variables for both eyebrows, have them work independently of each other. Usually, if every variable in a model is set to 0, you know, it's called the 0 pose. That's the default. The character's standing straight with his arms straight out to the sides and a blank expression. But once you start setting these animation variables, you know, and maybe you use a slider or something, you drag it back and forth to move his eyes up and down or whatever, I don't know. You start having the model move around and everything, you can achieve exactly the right pose and expression you want. And if you can't, then you go back to the model guy and he has to build another morph in there to allow you to manipulate it in a way that he didn't foresee. And the cameras and lights themselves are models with animation variables. So you can say, okay, from frame 10 to 20, move the camera from here to here and gradually change the color of the light from this to this, and you get tracking shots and dynamic lighting and all that. So 3D animation on a computer is really just a set of models with textures and colors and instructions on how to change the animation variables from frame to frame. Interesting stuff. Today, I would say the biggest name in terms of a company in 3D animation is still Pixar, which has their own in-house software that they developed to work with this animation. And they produced Toy Story, of course, which is the first fully 3D computer animated feature film. And obviously, they've continued to do very wonderful things since. And maybe starting with Shrek in 2000, other studios have jumped on board, and now everybody, it seems like, has an animation studio for doing this kind of thing, to the point where traditional animation is unfortunately kind of fallen by the wayside. I think that's kind of too bad, because some things are great for 3D animation and others are still better done traditionally. But definitely we see 3D animation becoming a huge, not just a fad, but something really people are interested in seeing. It's different than what we've had in decades, and so it looks nice. You can do a lot of dynamic and more realistic effects with it. Certainly you can do some wonderful things with 3D animation. So where do we go from here? Well, we've reached the end of our overview of animation. There's still a lot to talk about. Eventually, we'll get to segments that look at the Pixar films in more detail in another segment. But we'll take a break for a week or two first, and then we'll get back to talking about Looney Tunes and Disney. I mean, lots of great stuff still to come. So we got to wrap up the trivia question for this week, and it's about the movie that holds the record, 28 years, for the longest production schedule of a completed feature movie. And this is a very difficult question, Steven, so I'll be really impressed if you get even close, but do you have a guess?
Is it a documentary?
It is not, but that's actually a good guess.
That's what I would have guessed it would be. So it's a fiction film, 28 years it took them to make it.
I'll give you some clues here, and you might still not get it because it is pretty obscure. But it is okay. Vincent Price's final released acting role. It was released in 1995, and he recorded his part in 1968.
Wow!
And it is an animated movie, so it's his voice acting. All
animated movie from 1995. I have no idea.
Okay, well, the movie is The Thief and the Cobbler, and this was directed by Richard Williams. And actually, it was released under a number of different titles. Arabian Night and The Majestic Fool, so you might know it under a different title, but basically that's the movie.
Oh, sure, yeah, it was just blew up the box office under those titles, right?
Yes, it did. It was actually pretty well respected for an animated movie to come out at that time that wasn't Disney, so, you know, not a bad achievement, and certainly if you're pursuing something for 28 years and you just don't give up, I mean, that deserves some respect no matter what you turn out with. It also had Donald Pleasance and Anthony Quayle and Sean Connery, also as voice actors in it. And that's it for this week, but we've got a lot of stuff going on the website, as always, and if you've listened to us say this 1,000 times but never went there, well, that's why we say this 1,000 times. Go to allmovietalk.com. Check out a bunch of movie-related things there. We got bloopers on Fridays. We got a look at the old-timey days on Thursdays and a bunch of other things on other days. And also check out rinkworks.com, RinkWorks.com, bunch of movie-related stuff there, and other entertainment, too, humor and games and things like that.
And we'll be back next Tuesday with another episode. We'll be looking at the history of widescreen films. We're going to teach you how to solve a crime, if that becomes necessary. And our top six list is all going to be about stealing stuff. It's going to be our top six heist movies. So if you want to play along with the home version of the game, feel free to compile a list of your top six favorite heist movies and have them ready for next Tuesday, April 17th, when we return at allmovietalk.com. You're thinking, did he put five films on his list, or all six? Well, I guess you got to ask yourself one question, Sam. Do you feel lucky? Well, do ya?
Punk.
I wasn't going to diss you, man. I don't want to call you a punk.
You should have.
Oh.
That's all right. You can be nice to me if you want.